Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Baseball is widely hailed as our national pastime. It's certainly the sport with which the United States is most closely identified. So with another season underway, what better time to take a look at its history, which is what Fred Nielsen will be doing in a few minutes with baseball historian Jules Teigl. But first, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. This week in 1934, the celebrity criminal duo Bonnie and Clyde died in a police ambush. From the late summer of 1932 to May 23, 1934, Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow earned national notoriety for their criminal exploits across the South and Midwest. Clyde, raised in poverty, quit school at the age of 16 and began his criminal career in 1926 when he and his older brother Buck were arrested for stealing turkeys. In January 1930, he met Bonnie Parker, the product of a more middle-class family, who nonetheless joined Clyde in criminal exploits which endeared them to many law-abiding working-class people who were struggling through the Great Depression. They took law officers captive, locked them in their own handcuffs, and took them for long rides in their automobiles. They also photographed themselves in humorous poses, including one famous shot of Bonnie posing playfully with a gun while chomping on a cigar. Elevated to legendary status, the two young lovers became the subject of a massive manhunt that ended when they were killed by a five-man posse that poured 167 bullets into their vehicle along a road in Gibbsland, Louisiana. Gone but not forgotten, their stories were told in Arthur Penn's 1967 film, Bonnie and Clyde, starring Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Ellis Island officials in the Mormon Church have introduced a new online database containing arrival records for the 22 million immigrants who entered the port of New York from 1892 to 1924. The vast database, which includes 70% of all U.S. arrivals documented during that 30-year period, is available to Ellis Island visitors and on the Ellis Island website. The database includes the immigrants' names, their port of origin, age, nationality, hometown, and marital status. The British government has released secret files that reveal the British could not have broken the Enigma military code system used by the Germans during World War II without the help of Polish intelligence. The files, held at the Public Record Office in London, show that in 1939 Britain was given vital help by Polish intelligence agents who supplied parts of a captured 1938 Enigma machine and photographs of its encoding systems, in addition to vital details about the wiring system. For years, the breaking of the German Enigma codes has been hailed as a British triumph of ingenuity that shortened the Second World War, but the newly revealed documents show that Poland deserves credit for that achievement as well. This is Talking History. American baseball was one of the most cerebral games around, at least for the fans, who are well known for their encyclopedic knowledge of the game and its players, batting averages, ERAs, number of strikeouts and errors, and much more, all of which they are only too willing to share with one another during those long, lazy days in the grandstand. But baseball is more than just facts and figures. It is a long and venerable history, which is the subject of this week's interview with Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
Nine players on a side, a ball and a bat. Baseball is a game, but in the 150 years since its emergence, it has also shaped and reflected American culture. My guest, Jules Teigl, a professor of history at San Francisco State University, has written extensively about this interaction. His book, Baseball's Great Experiment, told the story of Jackie Robinson. His most recent book is Pastime, Baseball as History. Professor Teigl, welcome.
Thank you.
Many writers have portrayed baseball in romantic, metaphorical terms. Some have found it a uniquely American game, emphasizing independence, self-reliance, and equality. One writer whom you quote called it a Lockean game, a kind of contract theory in ritual form, its ideas derived from Madison, Jefferson, and Hamilton. And the famous Jacques Barzon, the historian, has famously remarked that whoever wants to know the heart and mind of America had better learn baseball. Are these things true?
No, I think that Barzon quote, which is often used, and it sort of hangs up there on the Baseball Hall of Fame as you walk in, as one of those exaggerations. He probably wishes he had never said it, so it's always always quoted. I think we can learn. Many people have written some very fine books about American history without looking at baseball, so I think that part is overly romanticized, and there seems to be a tendency, and this was particularly true, I think, in the 1980s and early 1990s, to go into these long flights of fancy about how baseball captures the American soul and spirit. I think that's quite improper. But what baseball, I think what we can say about baseball as a historian, certainly from the 1850s on, it's been a constant in American life. It's been a very important part of American life. And that we can view American life by looking at the changes that have taken place in baseball. Certainly if we look at something like the rise of statistics in baseball, it's reflecting a greater fascination with the rise of statistics in American society in the late 19th century. If we look at baseball's interaction with the radio, for example, in the 1920s and 30s, when radio was first breaking into the American consciousness, we can learn a lot about America, the changing pattern of American entertainment, the changing patterns, the way Americans absorb knowledge by looking at it through baseball.
Well, let's look at some of those things in turn. Baseball is about 150 years old, and it was, as you point out, well on its way to becoming the national game as early as the 1850s and 1860s. One striking example of that is a Currier and Ives print that your book reproduces from the 1860 election.
Yes, in 1860, and this is, in 1855, most Americans had never heard of baseball, had never seen baseball, and right about 1855, particularly in the New York area where it really begins, suddenly baseball becomes a craze, an enthusiasm. Club teams are forming in Manhattan, in Brooklyn. It begins to spread through the New York metropolitan area. Because New York is so much the center of trade and communications, other cities begin to pick up the game as well. And so by about 1859, there are many people in different parts of the country playing the game. And as early as 1856, when it was really only a New York game, people began to refer to this as the national game or the national pastime. And in 1860, in the aftermath of what was at that time, and still may be the most significant presidential election in our history, Currier and Ives put forth published a cartoon, and Currier and Ives was selling lithographs. It wasn't a newspaper. They basically sold cartoons and art pieces to a national audience, and the cartoon depicted the results of that 1860 election, and it showed Abraham Lincoln and his three major opponents, and the whole thing was done, and they all had bats, although Lincoln, of course, had a rail instead of a bat. They all had banners espousing their positions, and they all were speaking and describing the election in baseball terminology, that one candidate was skunked, that another one had struck out, that Lincoln had hit a home run. And what struck me in looking at this in 1860 is that here was a cartoon that a few years earlier would have been undecipherable to Americans, and yet by 1860, Currier and I felt that their audience would recognize the language, would understand the imagery, and use it to depict this important moment in American history.
You credit Henry Chadwick, who comes on the scene about this time, slightly after. He's a half-brother of a prominent British reformer, with creating the game, at least the form of the game, that Americans have celebrated and enjoyed over the years. What exactly was it that Chadwick did?
Chadwick invents not the game on the field, but he invents the fans' game, the sports writers' game. Chadwick is very much a social reformer. He's very much a modern man of his times, and he sees baseball as, first of all, something that should be embraced by all Americans. He understands that if we're going to have a national game, the game has to have national standards. And so it's Chadwick who invents the scoring system that we use today to keep track of the game. It's Chadwick who invents many of the statistics that we still use, things like the batting average. He invents the box score, which enables us to keep track of what's happening. And so what Chadwick is creating here is the historical essence of the game. He's creating the fact that we can compare players that are playing in 2000 with players who played in the 1880s based on their statistics is very much a part of Chadwick's accomplishment and achievement, because he understood that for the game to have a history, we had to have careful record keeping. It had to be standardized. You had to measure things, you know, in a consistent way. And he was very fanatical about all of this, and fanatical about the way it should be done. In fact, some of his innovations probably have not served us all that well. For example, the batting average is a terrible statistic for measuring the worth of a hitter. But his overall handiwork has created the game we know today.
He's interesting, too, because he's not just collecting numbers for historical purposes or interest of fans. There's a kind of moral purpose behind it, too, isn't there?
Well, Chadwick came out of that antebellum social reform movement. His brother, Edwin Chadwick, in England, was one of the pioneers in using statistics to get a handle on social reform and changes that had to be made. And so both of them came out of this fervor that existed. In the pre-Civil War era, it was, you know, anti-slavery, and it was prohibition, and other issues about revolving around the poor, and there were many issues where people tried to create this moral universe where those who did good things should be rewarded and those who did bad things should be punished. And one sees that in Chadwick's own box scores. Even he creates a concept of earned runs, which were runs that a team got based on its own effort, and unearned runs, which were based on the bad things the other team did. And he wanted to make sure that everybody knew who got the earned runs and who got the unearned runs. There was this was sort of like a dichotomy between the deserving and the undeserving poor for who should receive charity. So there was he was very much motivated by the moral world in which he came from.
You mentioned earlier that one of the big transformations in American culture comes to affect baseball, too, is the rise of mass communications in the 1920s. Commercial radio, of course, appears then. How did this mass communication revolution change or affect baseball?
Well, it's interesting. In American history, if you look at the years just after World War I, 1919, 1920, there are a whole series of communication breakthroughs that change the way Americans absorb information. Prior to this time, we were primarily a literary society, a society in which we got most of our information from reading the newspapers, or from reading periodicals, from words. Increasingly, after 1920, we become much more of a visual and an audio society. And so, for example, in right around 1919, we see the emergence of tabloid newspapers, which are much more focused on photographs, much less on text, big headlines, colorful photographs, and this becomes the rage in newspapers. Also around that time, the newsreel becomes much more modernized and much more a feature of American life. And, of course, the movies themselves have become much more a dominant feature in American life. And then finally, again, right at that moment, right around 1920, radio appears. And so all of these things enable Americans to absorb baseball in a different way than they always had, and to experience the game more intimately. Certainly, particularly for the World Series, one can sit in one's own home and actually know what's happening as it happens. This was a revolutionary event, and of course all of this is going to sort of coalesce around the figure of Babe Ruth, who is this larger-than-life figure both on the field and off the field. But it's Ruth who is able to become one of the first two modern celebrities in America, because he appears right at the moment of this intersection of tabloid newspapers, newsreels, radio, and so that people can, you know, they can see Babe Ruth, they can hear Babe Ruth, even though they might never actually get to see him play in a baseball game.
Ruth, of course, hit a lot of homers, but the most famous home run ever hit was not one of his. It's the shot heard around the world, Bobby Thompson's home run in the playoff game of 1951, the Giants and the Dodgers. Of all the thousands and thousands of home runs ever hit, why does that Thompson home run stand out?
Well, I think partly it stands out because of the sheer drama. It culminated a pennant race that in which pitted, of course, the two New York teams in the National League, the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers. The Giants had come from way behind to catch the Dodgers on the in the last week of the of the, of the regular season. The two teams had tied. They then played in a three-game playoff. The Giants won the first game. The Dodgers won the second. The Dodgers were ahead going into the ninth inning of the final game, and Thompson's home run overtook them and allowed the Giants to win. So I think just the sheer drama of that moment, you know, cannot be denied. But also, this occurred at another intersection of American communication. It occurred, it's really simultaneously the last great moment of radio sports and the first great moment of television sports. The home run is very much embedded in people's memories because of the famous home run call by the Giants announcer Russ Hodges. But when Thompson hits the home run, he says, "The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant." And whenever we see replays of it, that's superimposed on those on the video that we have, as to create that as one seamless moment. But the truth is that most people watching the game at that time did not hear the call of Hodges. Not only those listening to his version of the radio broadcast, which is one of several. But this was also many people, particularly in the New York area, were watching the game on television, because television had now emerged as a major player in the creation of sports information. And this was the first nationally broadcast televised event, because they had just planted a coaxial cable, which allowed for live television from, you know, in places like Denver and Los Angeles across the nation. So for many people, this was their first experience with a televised sports event, and of course it was the most exciting thing they'd ever seen. And so I think this also helped to embed it and place this in American minds. An event that normally would have done it was sort of escalated and elevated in their minds because of this intersection of media that took place.
TV is new around 1950. That's one revolutionary change. But there are other changes afoot, too, having to do especially with the race and in some ways style of play. You quote one sports writer saying that baseball in 1950 stood at the end of the era built by Babe Ruth, and you continue that it poised on the brink of an age forged by Jackie Robinson and especially Willie Mays. Describe the difference between those two eras. What exactly was changing?
Well, the Ruthian game was largely a power game. It was a game, in fact, not that dissimilar to the game of the 1990s and the early 21st century. Ruth, by introducing or reintroducing the home run as the major weapon of offense, really had, in many ways, reduced the strategic elements of the game. It became sort of the Big Bang theory of baseball. You get a couple of guys on, you hit a home run, and that's the game. So on the field, things like stealing bases and some of the other strategic elements had been reduced and minimized. When Jackie Robinson comes in, one of the first things that people notice about him, and of course one of the great skills that he had, was his tremendous speed and his base running. And Robinson, of course, is bringing, what Robinson is doing is bringing the Negro League game, which had always been a much more freewheeling, wide-open game, with lots of speed and base running, into the major league. And as more black players come in, and it's very, very slow in the late 40s and early 50s, as teams sort of grudgingly accept integration, many of these players also have tremendous speed. In fact, from 1949 on, there are hardly any white players who ever lead the league in stolen bases anymore. It's almost all black and then later Hispanic players who are going to be the consummate base stealers in American baseball. Mays sort of ups the ante even a little bit more, because Mays combines the power and speed. Mays has the power of a Babe Ruth, but he also has the speed and steals bases and becomes really the quintessential complete baseball player, and it's Mays in many ways. But when Robinson comes in, there's still this notion among many baseball owners who are not the wisest of people or the most far-sighted of people that, well, you know, this is Jackie Robinson, and there aren't that many people who, he's an extraordinary case, and there aren't that many, you know, black players who can come in and do what he does. By the time Mays comes in 1951, and they take one look at Willie Mays and say, wow, if that's what's out there, we better start looking for more black players. And it's at that time that I think integration really becomes a much more widespread and accomplished thing in baseball.
We have only about a minute or so left, but there's a theme that runs through your book. There's a kind of tug-of-war conflict between innovators and traditionalists, what you've described as one aspect of that. I wonder, as you survey the history of the game, its century and a half, who has generally had the better of it, the innovators or the traditionalists?
Well, I think in the folklore of the game, the traditionalists have the better of it, and that's many of the things that hold the game together, this vast nostalgic quality that sort of embeds baseball into American culture so deeply. I think on the field and in the promotions of the game, the realism of the game, it's the Branch Rickeys, the Larry McPhails who introduces night baseball and spreads radio baseball. It's the people who have changed the game and have modernized the game as the times modernized that have really been just as important as those people who cling to the tradition.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We've been listening to Jules Seidel, author of Pastime, Baseball as History.
How did I get on third base?
Why, you mentioned his name.
If I mentioned a third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
What's
on second?
I don't know.
He's on third.
There I go, back on third again. You stay on third base,
right.
Don't go off it.
All right, nobody will know.
Now, who's playing third base?
Why do you insist on putting who on third base?
What am I putting on third?
What is on second?
You don't want who on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know. Third base!
American baseball is not just a game. It's also a business. Big business for those cities in which major league teams choose to locate and for whom cities build large, expensive stadiums. But then there is a history to this stadium game, as explained in this week's op-ed by Neil Sullivan. Sullivan is a professor of public affairs at Baruch College in New York City and the author of The Dodgers Move West, The Miners, and The Diamond in the Bronx.
The stadium game in Major League Baseball has entered a new era, but it remains a game that is full of false promise. New ballparks in Milwaukee and Pittsburgh join a growing list of retro-designed facilities that have offered commercial hope to small-market teams. That hope may not long survive because the Dodgers, Mets, and Red Sox are rich franchises that may move into new stadiums of their own. And even those deals would be unlikely to rival the commercial advantage that Yankee Stadium affords the perennial world champions. Over 60,000 fans attended the first opening day in the Bronx on a brisk April 18, 1923. The crowd was three times greater than the attendance at other American League openers, and it was at least twice the size of the largest crowds in the National League. Teams in that era might draw 600,000 fans over an entire season. The Yankees had built a plant that could draw that number in a single homestand. For the next 40 years, Yankee Stadium became the home of champions, the setting for Babe Ruth's home runs, the stage for Lou Gehrig's tragic farewell, and the place where Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris chased 61. In the 1970s, Yankee Stadium changed fundamentally. Fearing that the team would be sold out of state and would follow the Dodgers and Giants out of the city, Mayor John Lindsay led the fight to assume the stadium as a public obligation, renovate it, and lease it back to the Yankees. That lease expires after the 2002 season, and the most fiscally conservative proposals to date contemplate a public subsidy of several hundred million dollars. The relationship between Yankee owners and the city is curious. Colonel Jacob Rupert built the stadium, and even though he was well connected with Tammany Hall and a beer baron in the midst of Prohibition, he financed the great structure privately. The Columbia Broadcasting System, CBS, owned the Yankees when Mayor Lindsay rebuilt the stadium for them. At that very time, New York City was headed for bankruptcy, and the stadium's neighborhood in the South Bronx was becoming a metaphor for an urban nightmare. Now New York City must consider again its relationship with the Yankees and their stadium. George Steinbrenner has restored the dynasty and has merged the Yankees with the New Jersey Nets of the National Basketball Association and the New Jersey Devils of the National Hockey League. Why this most prosperous firm in American sports should be subsidized by the public in an era of welfare reform is a puzzle. If we have enough money to refurbish the old ball yard, That should be news to children who live in squalor and whose classrooms and playing fields are a mess. The subsidy should also trouble taxpayers in other cities who agreed to pay for new ballparks in the false hope that their heroes would remain competitive with the Yankees.
You've been listening to Neil Sullivan, the author of The Diamond in the Bronx, Yankee Stadium and the Politics of New York, just published by Oxford University Press. This is Talking History.
The North Side diehard stole the show.
The land of racing in my soul. Come on, come and let the band roll. Roll all day long.
For our site of the week, we could hardly avoid reminding you of the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum, the mecca of American baseball. Here to tell you all about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
No baseball lover season would be complete without a visit to the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown, New York. Here you will find more than 30,000 objects that represent all facets of the game, including baseballs, bats, uniforms, awards, tickets, and much, much more. New this year is the Memories of a Lifetime, the Barry Halper Collection, the first exhibit featured in the Barry Halper Gallery, and is scheduled to be on display through the summer of 2001. And don't miss the Hall of Fame weekend, August 4th through the 6th, when the newest members will be inducted to the Hall of Fame. A day at the Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum is as good, if not better, than a day at the ballpark.
Finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, the History Channel will air three programs on Memorial Day, recalling some of the nation's more dramatic moments in military history and better-known military units. The Complete History of the Navy SEALs is scheduled for May 28th, telling the story of that much-decorated Special Navy Combat and Demolition Unit commissioned in 1962 by President John Kennedy. That will be followed by A Complete History of the Green Berets. John Kennedy called their trademark beret a symbol of excellence, a badge of courage, and a mark of distinction in the fight for freedom. The special program explains how the unit became one of the world's most unconventional fighting groups. And for your continued Memorial Day television enjoyment, watch for This Week in History, a program with several segments related to Memorial Day, including a history of the holiday and examinations of events surrounding Pearl Harbor and the making of the recent film of that name. The Civil War, Union Army's all-black 54th Regiment, made famous by the movie Glory, and the German submarine U-151 that sank six American vessels off the coast of New Jersey on June 2, 1918. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtimes of these History Channel presentations on Memorial Day. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Yes!